We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots to cover.
Yes.
Starting with the Seattle waterfront.
Yeah, the city council this week started looking at proposed changes to the waterfront, and in particular, the funding proposal. Now, the Central Waterfront Committee, that's a group of folks who had been appointed to come up with plans for changes to the waterfront and in particular, a funding proposal to try to pay for some of those changes. And it includes lots of developers, especially on the finance committee, came up with a couple of plans this week that they submitted to the city council. In particular, one that was produced by the finance committee that would show how much the changes would cost. Well, according to the Seattle Times, they did a little article on it. According to the Seattle Times, it will cost about $420 million, with half coming from the local improvement district set up of businesses to pay for the changes. Well, no, that's wrong. That's a gross understatement. When you start looking at the plan submitted, you see that it's going to cost at least $1.2 billion with guarantees that it will go higher than that.
And that's on top of the $4 billion that's already being spent on the tunnel, yeah, which is essentially for the same reason, which is to develop the waterfront.
These have nothing to do with the traffic tunnel. This is sort of the beautification project.
Right.
According to the Central Waterfront Committee's strategic plan, quote, this is a direct quote, certain promising elements of the long-term vision identified in the city's framework plan are not funded in this funding plan, end quote. That's the plan that says it's going to cost $1.2 billion.
In other words, we got a bunch of great ideas, and we don't know where the money's going to come from, but we'll commit to it anyway.
And we set out to do a funding plan, and we haven't completed that funding plan. We're just giving you the first pieces, and it's, guess what, folks? It's $1.2 billion. And further, the graph that was reprinted on the Seattle PI website is highly misleading. This is the graph that was included in the funding plan. It shows that 60% of their so-called funding plan is quote-unquote secured/pending funding. Yeah.
Doesn't pending mean not secured?
I would say that it does. Of that amount, about half is the 30-year seawall bond that is on the November ballot. And if that doesn't pass, that means about 30% of the total funding for the plan is off the table.
So that would also mean not secured.
Yeah, not secured. So and of that, the other about a little more than half of that so-called secured funding is a combination of city and WashDOT funds, state transportation funds. And as we know from past experience, state transportation funds, while it might be allocated today, might change with the next legislative session. Of the rest of the funding, 23% would come from private business. That's from the new local improvement district of downtown property owners whose boundaries have still not been set. About 11% would come from philanthropy, in other words, from private donations. And the remaining $150 million or so is called quote-unquote other city source and from the city's general fund, which means, yes, more taxpayer funds over and above the 30-year seawall bond will be needed for this project. And that of that other city source, they're hoping that the bulk of that will come from a second ballot measure, which will be held sometime in 2014 to 2016. So this upcoming vote in November is not the only vote you'll be taking on waterfront improvement projects. There's going to be another one further down the road.
At least one.
And given that
the motivation behind a lot of this, politically speaking anyway, is primarily, you know, real estate development, I'm fairly secure in the knowledge that you know, we're going to get screwed.
All right. Well, sticking with that theme, the arena updates this week, a meeting with the King County Council.
Oh, yeah. The King County Council heard this week from a group of arena experts that they appointed in order to analyze the Chris Hansen plan to build a third arena in the SoDo area of Seattle. Now, they looked at some different aspects of the plan. One of them was the economic impact, and I just wanted to quote this great sentence from the Seattle Times article that summarized.
Oh, I'll bet it's the same one that I came down.
Oh, it could be. It said, quote, "The proposal wouldn't significantly influence the level of income or employment in the region." So that just sort of says it all there. It's not going to bring any new jobs to the region.
Wasn't actually the one that I pulled.
Oh, yeah. No, that's good. That's good. Because, you know, you and I, we complement each other. We look at different aspects of these things. So,
But it comes to the same thing. It was not that it wouldn't in the future, but that it hadn't in the past. Specifically, that Key Arena, when the Sonics were there, had produced less than 0.1% of jobs in the region when it housed the Sonics. In other words, when you heard all those arguments several years ago when Clay Bennett was making all his arena proposals, that if we didn't save the Sonics, it would cost all of these jobs and it would be a tremendous blow to the economy of the region, et cetera, et cetera. No, that's nonsense. And the same is true for this new arena. It will have negligible impact economically.
Yeah. And in addition, they did what they said was a market analysis. They looked at whether a new team would be able to really flourish here in the city of Seattle. And what they came up with was something that we already know and that we've already talked about on this program, that Seattle would be the third most sports saturated city in the United States. In other words, this city is the third worst city in the nation for bringing in a new team.
But that's actually not true. And the reason it's not true is that the premise of that would be that they would bring in both an NBA and an NHL team.
True. And I don't think they'd be able to do that.
No, as we've discussed on this program before, and this also was the premise, by the way, of the $80 million figure that the county was considering for this whole process as being the county's share of public spending. That $80 million is going to go up substantially if both leagues are not here. And as we've talked about, there is absolutely no precedent for both the NBA and the NHL moving to the same city. It has never happened, and given how few teams actually ever move and the number of cities that want to get a new team, it's highly, highly unlikely.
Yeah, and even if we got only one team, it would still take fans, attendance, and money from the other teams. That's what the experts told the King County Council this week. And in addition, they said that the Chris Hansen plan would need major transportation improvements, not for car traffic. That's what's been mostly talked about up till now, but for pedestrians, trains, and bus stops. So essentially just to make the arena a place where people can park and walk or walk from their downtown jobs, or a place just where people can get off the bus and go to, they would need major transportation improvements, which, guess what, folks, is not going to be paid for by the private investors. It's going to come out of our pockets.
All right. Charter schools.
Yeah, the Yes on 1240 campaign, that's the group that paid to collect signatures to get the charter school initiative on the ballot. They filed their public disclosure filings this week, and it turns out that they spent about $2.1 million to collect a total of about 350,000 signatures. That averages out to about $6 per signature. Now, if you ask how did these folks get the money, it is kind of interesting to see who their major donors are. Bill Gates gave $1 million to the campaign. Mike and Jackie Bezos, those are the parents of Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon. They gave $500,000. Paul Allen gave $100,000. And Reed Hastings, the co-founder of Netflix and a guy who sits on the board of a company that manages charter schools, he gave $100,000 too. Now,
sounds like a real grassroots effort.
Oh, it does, doesn't it? Now, the opponents, people who are against the charter school initiative, they're a group called People for Our Public Schools. They've raised only about $16,000. In part, that's because the charter school initiative hasn't been qualified for the ballot yet by the state. Now, in the past, we've voted on charter school initiatives before. In 2004, the charter school initiative raised $4 million and still failed at the ballot. And in 2000, they raised the same amount of money. And their biggest donor was Paul Allen, who gave most of the cash for that 2000 initiative. He gave more than $3 million to try to get charter schools passed in the state of Washington, but failed then as well.
And there was another one in 96 that was also big money. So this is a very consistent pattern.
Yeah, it tends to be the rule for charter schools.
All right. Moving on, City of Seattle weighing in on the on anti-DOMA.
The City of Seattle filing an amicus brief this week in a Ninth District Court appeal of a lawsuit which was won in lower court challenging the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. That lawsuit was filed in part by City of Seattle employee Ken Molesbury and his husband Chris. The city was listed so that employers in states with same-sex marriage laws, and assuming the referendum is upheld this fall, that state of Washington will be one of those states, that cities like Seattle can provide employees and their spouses with the same benefits as married heterosexual couples. So for all the criticism that we've given of Mike McGinn on various issues, this is one area where they did something good this week.
All right. And then finally, a SWAT raid earlier this week.
Yeah, speaking of things where City of Seattle didn't do something quite as good, the Seattle Police Department launching a raid on early Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. on an apartment in the Central District used by Occupy Seattle activists. This, according to SPD, was in response to the quote-unquote riots from May 1st, the May Day protests. Now, mind you, given that all of the laws that were broken were basically misdemeanors, minor graffiti and vandalism, it's amazing that over 2 months later, you have literally SWAT teams breaking down doors with guns drawn at 6 o'clock in the morning, looking for the perpetrators.
Throwing
a stun grenade,
yeah.
Right, at the same time. So this strikes me as something where the May Day demonstrations were used as a pretext, basically for harassment of dissidents in the city. Now, particularly ridiculous on this was the search warrant that was used for this raid, because they were looking for, among other things, anarchist materials, which, aside from the fact that there's nothing illegal about
anarchist materials,
and,
I wonder.
Bakunin's autobiography, I mean, who knows?
Maybe, who knows? I don't know.
I'd love to see a good definition of what that would include, but the fact that they were looking for anarchist materials was a little difficult because the apartment in question is used by a local collective that belongs to something called the Kasama Project, which happens to be a national Maoist organization. SPD hasn't gotten the memo yet.
Yes, here's a little primer for the SPD.
A helpful tip.
Anarchists and Maoists, when it comes to leftist activists, they're on opposite ends of the spectrum. You rarely find them in the same room.
And
together.
They hate each other.
Yes. yes.
Interesting. In addition to the anarchist materials, they also took a hat and a scarf and a single glove, which suggests that either they were looking for DNA evidence off of the spray painted graffiti in May, or
they're trying to match these with video they've taken of other events.
Yeah, or they're stocking up on back to school supplies, or I'm looking for the courtroom trial later this year in
or
which
it's just
the,
harassment
or in which the defense attorney says is the single glove does not fit, you have to acquit.
All right. Let's move on to national, plenty to cover there as well, starting with the cell phone privacy, or the lack thereof.
Yeah, a congressional inquiry into cell phone privacy has subpoenaed or has requested documents from several large cell phone carriers to find out how many requests are being made from law enforcement agencies for data on cell phone users. They're finding that in 2011, cell phone carriers responded to 1.3 million demands for subscriber info from law enforcement agencies, and that is way higher than they ever expected. And those are just the demands that cell phone carriers responded to. There were many, many, many more demands that weren't backed up by a search warrant, a subpoena, or a court order that cell phone carriers didn't respond to. Sprint, for example, said that they get about 1,500 data requests per day from different law enforcement agencies. And often a single request would include data for multiple callers. For example, a law enforcement agency might say, we need a cell phone tower dump of data so that we can find information on one caller who made a call near that cell phone tower on a certain day at a certain time. And that could end up giving that law enforcement agency data on hundreds or even thousands of callers in a single at a single time. Now, the ACLU in the past has found that many state and local police departments try and often get their hands on cell phone data without court orders or subpoenas or search warrants by simply claiming that an emergency exists. And in many cases, an emergency didn't really exist.
Moving on, global warming updates.
Yeah, there was a Washington Post Stanford poll this week that found that a majority of Americans, approximately 60%, say that global temperatures are up and that weather has become more unstable in recent years. So we're headed in the right direction, folks. A majority of Americans do really believe that that this data is real.
It's really staggering, though, that 40%
don't.
Is not.
No, it is. And they found that when they went on and asked other questions, they found that 66% of Americans favor tax breaks to curb greenhouse gas emissions, while 70% oppose tax increases on electricity or gas. But I didn't see the actual wording of the questions. It'd be interesting to see if the pollers correctly described what a carbon tax would involve. Now, only 20% of Americans want government to not regulate greenhouse gases. This, I think, is kind of interesting, given that the media often says that that Americans don't want government to interfere when it comes to the environment.
And when the representation of that viewpoint between free media and the enormous amount of paid advertising that's done by the energy industry, would lead you to believe that that's much more disputed.
Yeah.
All right. Tangential to that.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration also this week releasing information on global warming, which was the ratio of temperature records in the United States that are record highs versus record lows. Now, there are tens of thousands of each across the United States each year, given how many different, large and small communities there are. And you would expect in an average year, all other things being equal, it would be 50-50. There'd be the same number of record highs and record lows.
Roughly, yeah.
Roughly. Well, over time. And with that large a sample size. Well, in 2009, they had a record for the degree to which it had been skewed in the direction of record high temperatures. A full 56% of all the temperature records were high records. In 2010, they broke that record. They were at 70% that were record highs and only 30% that were record lows. 2011, a new record. 73% were record highs, 27% were record lows.
Yes. Are you seeing a trend here?
Yes. So would you care to guess what it is so far for 2012?
No. Why don't you go ahead and tell me?
90% for record highs, 10% for record lows, and 40% who don't think it's getting warmer.
Yeah.
Medicaid.
Yeah, four states have so far said that they won't expand Medicaid under the Health Reform Act. Those states are South Carolina, Louisiana, Florida, and Texas. Florida is the fourth largest state in the United States by population, with over 20% of their population uninsured. Texas this week came forward and said that they would not expand Medicaid. And Texas, this is particularly disturbing since they have a 25% uninsured rate. That's about 6.2 million people, of which over a million are children.
Yeah, the second largest state by population.
They're the second largest state by population. They also have the highest rate of uninsured people in the nation. In Houston, the state's biggest city, over 30% of their population is uninsured. So this week, Republican Governor Rick Perry saying, well, the poor can just go jump in a lake as far as I'm concerned.
Well, no, what he said actually was Texas has the finest healthcare system in the world.
And which is a lie.
And we don't need any help, which, in terms of the healthcare he accesses is probably true.
Oh, that's true. And also this week, he also sent a letter to the feds saying that Texas will not will officially not set up an insurance exchange. So not only can the poor go jump in a lake, but the middle class can too. Governor Rick Perry basically was saying, well, nope, we're not even going to let people compare comparable plans in my state.
Well, the irony of that, of course, is that under the guidelines of the ACA, if the state does not set up those exchanges, the federal government will have to.
Yeah.
And that, of course, will lead to a bunch more rhetoric by Perry or his successor complaining about intrusion of the federal government and threatening to secede and so forth, which, quite frankly, I could root for that.
Yeah, you know, Texas hasn't always been a Republican state, so maybe we'll see a swing in the other direction there.
CBO report out on taxes?
Yeah, came out this week, the Congressional Budget Office, and of course people like Rick Perry complaining constantly about how terribly overtaxed the wealthy are and businesses and so forth. Well, they're wrong, actually. In 2009, which is the last year that the CBO had available to analyze, Americans, and that includes both businesses and individuals, paid the lowest tax rates in 30 years to the federal government. So the next time you hear taxed enough already, they're lying.
That's right. And then I wanted to talk this week about the collapse of another brokerage firm. We talked about in the past about MF Global, the huge brokerage firm that collapsed. Well, this week, Peregrine, a futures trading firm, also collapsed. It's interesting because what Peregrine does is it helps line up buyers and sellers of futures contracts for commodities. So in general, they're dealing with derivatives. Now, their customers' bank accounts were found to be short at least $200 million. The CEO and chairman of Peregrine, Russell Wassendorf Sr., he also sits on the advisory committee of the National Futures Association. That's the lead regulator for his company, Peregrine. So what I see there is a very clear conflict of interest. Wassendorf had dug in his heels and had said, as an advisor to the National Futures Association, he had tried to prevent them from setting up an online auditing system that would allow the National Futures Association to directly look at customers' account balances by getting their online banking information and matching it to what the brokerage firms were reporting to them. And clearly this week, as soon as they set up that online auditing system, they could very clearly see that Peregrine, whose CEO had advised them not to set up their online auditing system, had been cheating.
I'm seeing a fox owning a national chain of hen houses.
Yes, that shows you the state of regulation in the United States, doesn't it?
Hmm. Wells Fargo and the Department of Justice?
Yeah, Wells Fargo becoming the latest bank this past week to settle a Department of Justice lawsuit. They'll only pay $175 million for the sin of systematically funneling African American applicants in the 2000s into subprime mortgages and then charging more for those applicants than for non-African American applicants. Now, that affecting some 34,000 plaintiffs, so it's only about a $5,000 payout per plaintiff, less the legal cut, of course. So that's actually quite a bit less than Wells Fargo actually made on those practices.
Yes.
It is a drop in the bucket, in fact.
And Wells Fargo could probably pay a lot more.
Oh, of course they could. It's very similar to past settlements that have been made with other banks for similar types of practices. $335 million, for example, for Countrywide and Bank of America in December. So this was not just an aberration. This was an industry-wide practice. Mm-hmm. And these practices are not just fraudulent practices. They're felonies because they involve systematic, intentional racial discrimination. That violates all kinds of federal laws, but nobody's going to jail. Nobody's facing criminal investigation, let alone charges. Instead, Wells Fargo is paying a fine that they can easily afford to pay without particularly noticing.
Pretty much
and
they get slap on the wrist.
And they get to keep all the profits they made by doing it. Where is the disincentive for not doing it all over again?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And update this week on the LIBOR scandal.
Oh, this has been a bunch going on with that. The New York Fed, in the most interesting development, released documents this week saying that they had learned from a Barclays Bank employee in April of 2008. Now, this being, of course, at the very beginning of the economic downturn, that, quote, "we know we're not posting an honest rate," talking about the LIBOR rate that 16 banks got together and posted of the money that they loaned from from one to the other, and then that in turn is used for setting all sorts of other daily rates and rates in contracts. Some $800 trillion worth of contracts worldwide. According to documents released Friday, employees were indicated at the time that other big banks had made similarly bogus reports, and were saying that Barclays wanted to fit in with the rest of the crowd, quote unquote. Now, the interesting thing.
That's not a good excuse for cheating.
No, it really isn't. Well, yeah, I shot that guy in cold blood, but you know, other people do it too.
The astonishing thing is that they were saying these to regulators like the New York Fed and to British regulators, and nothing was done.
No.
Nothing was done.
No.
Now, Timothy Geithner can say, oh, I have emails and I have copies of memos saying that I informed British regulators that this might be happening. But, you know, we got to look at the back and forth and really see, okay, so you were talking about it. Why didn't you do something?
Yeah, the New York Times narrative of this was particularly amusing in its understatedness. Quote, although the New York Fed conferred with British and American regulators about problems and recommended reforms, it failed to stop illegal activity, end quote.
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth?
The fallout from this is deep and wide. We have municipal governments. We have local governments that are going bankrupt because of the LIBOR scandal. And you have to kind of understand how debt works on the municipal level to really understand how LIBOR could influence the income for local governments. But trust me, it really has in the last 4 or 5 years undercut what state and local governments could collect on contracts they made with banks. It really was in the bank's favor, and it really has impacted state and local governments a lot, and that has impacted the local economies all over the United States.
And in case anybody missed it and was wondering what kind of accountability there will be for this huge, massive fraud, Barclays has already secured a non-prosecution agreement with the DOJ and agreed to pay a penalty of more than $450 million.
Which is a slap on the wrist.
Yep.
All right. Also this week, new rules for derivatives?
Yeah, regulators in the United States have approved new rules for derivatives, finally. And you might ask, are they rigorous? Well, no, they contain a huge loophole.
Why would you ask that?
Yeah, about 30,000 manufacturers, utilities, oil companies, and airlines around the United States will be exempt from the rules. They won't have to submit their derivatives contracts to a central clearinghouse where they can be kept track of. Also, banks and other financial firms with less than $10 billion in assets are also exempt, supposedly to keep small banks from having to report their derivatives contracts. However, why wouldn't you just
set up a small holding company?
Yes, I can definitely see a huge loophole whereby big banks and financial companies would spin off assets into smaller holding companies in order to avoid having to send information on their derivatives to a central clearinghouse. It really is a bad rule, I think.
All right. Also, J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan announced this week that the loss they had reported earlier on one type of derivatives trade done by their London trading desk won't be only $1 to $2 billion in loss. It'll be $5.8 billion and could go as high as $7.5 billion. And folks, this is just one type of derivatives trade that they made and that they loaded up on their London trading desk. And it really points to how we need much, much stronger regulation.
All right. And then finally, jumping to international for a second, Burma.
Yeah, this week the U.S. State Department said that they were lifting many sanctions on Burma, Myanmar, as it is sometimes called in the international press. And this is in spite of human rights groups and Burmese activists urging the State Department not to lift sanctions on, particularly on companies that they know have done business or are held by the Burmese military. However, the U.S. State Department came back and said, well, we want to make sure that United States companies can get a little bit of that oil and that gas that's coming out of Burma.
Well, yeah, Hillary Clinton said that the Burmese military is seeing the light now, so it must be all good.
Yeah,
right?
So the State Department went ahead and lifted some of the sanctions.
Events.
Yeah, and next Thursday, Common Good Cafe will have a talk by author Deborah Jang Stein, founder of the Unprison Project to help incarcerated women and their children. Mike, where's the
University Temple United Methodist Church
in the University District,
1415 Northeast 43rd, I believe.
Yes, yeah, 43rd and 15th Northeast.
That's from 7 to 9 p.m. next Thursday.
Behind the post office. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eattestate.org, behind the post office.
You can find some of my past articles at my website, www.mariatomchick.com.